Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Midweek Update. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. Columbus, Ohio. Marijuana decriminalization qualifies for local Ohio ballot, with activists working to secure more measures. Ohio activists have qualified a measure to decriminalize marijuana to appear on local 2021 ballot, the first of dozens of reform proposals that could go before voters this year as signature gathering efforts continue across the state. The Hocking County Board of Elections certified on Wednesday that advocates that had collected enough valid signatures to put the question of decriminalization before the voters in Murray City. This is the latest development in year-long passage of grassroots push to get enacted policy changes at the local level, while statewide efforts have failed. All told, 22 Ohio jurisdictions have adopted local statutes so far that reduce the penalty for low-level cannabis possessions from a misdemeanor punishable by jail time to a fine to the lowest penalty allowed by the state law. Normal and Sensible Movement Coalition have spearheaded the Ohio decriminalization movement. Activists expect to see more reform measures validated by boards of elections across the state in the coming days and weeks. Reform groups had hoped to secure even more wins last year, but the coronavirus pandemic derailed many efforts. While four cities approved the policy changes in 2020, advocates initially planned to target a total of 14 municipalities. Washington, D.C. A top investigator into the January 6 insurrection on Congress told lawmakers at a recent hearing that the Capitol Police shouldn't be wasting resources busting people for smoking marijuana when they have more serious responsibilities to carry out, and a GOP congressman said he agrees. Lieutenant General Jeffrey Buchanan, who served as the deputy leader of the Capitol Attack Review Task Force, made remarks during the hearing before the House Administrative Committee on Wednesday. In discussing the law enforcement shortcomings that enabled people to storm the building, he said police would be better prepared if they weren't pursuing low-level cannabis offenses. To resolve the manpower problem of the police force, Buchanan said, a reevaluation of enforcement priorities is in order. Quote, I mean, if our officers are busting teenagers for smoking marijuana over at the train station, I know that this is against the law. But if it doesn't have anything to do with protecting the Capitol or its members, it's probably a waste of time and energy. He said, it requires a cultural change. It has to start at the top, but more importantly, it has to be driven by our actions every day. Across America, eight states side with cancer patients in psilocybin lawsuit against the DEA. A bipartisan group of attorney generals from eight states and the District of Columbia have sided with cancer patients in a lawsuit against the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency that seeks legal access to psilocybin, a compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, for end-of-life care. The patients and Seattle-based palliative care physician Dr. Suna Angawar sued the DEA in March after the agency denied their application to legally use the synthetic form of the drug under the state and federal right to try laws, which give patients with terminal conditions the opportunity to try investigational medications that have not been approved for general use. A friend of the court brief filed late last week in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, the state attorney general said that DEA rejection of the patient's application was an overreach of the agency's power, noting that the therapeutic potential of not only the psilocybin, but MDMA. A brief urges that the court to rule in patients' favor. Our last story is from Washington, D.C. A key chairman plans to file revised federal marijuana legalization bill in the House as early as next week. A key chairman plans to reintroduce a bill to federally legalize marijuana and promote social equity in the industry as early as next week in the House, and its text will contain at least two notable changes compared to the last version of the legislation. The news comes as advocates eagerly anticipate the filing of a separate cannabis reform bill planned by Senate leaders. The Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or the MORE Act, sponsored by House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler, cleared the chamber in a historic vote last year, but did not advance in the Senate under GOP control. According to an email thread from advocacy groups, it is set to be refiled as soon as next week with some new provisions. Four sources familiar with the strategy also said their understanding is that Nadler plans to introduce a revised legislation ahead of the Congress Memorial Day recess, though a spokesman in the chamber's office was not able to confirm details by press time. The new bill will not include language that was added just before last year's House floor vote that would have prevented people with previous cannabis convictions from obtaining federal permits to operate marijuana businesses. That was a contentious provision that appeared at the last minute, of which advocates strongly opposed. And whereas the prior version of the MORE Act contained language to help economically disadvantaged people enter the legal marijuana market, that language is being revised to extend Small Business Administration aid, such as loans, financial literacy programs, and jobs training, to help people who have been harmed by the war on drugs pursue business opportunities in any industry, not just cannabis. And that's your America's Cannabis Conversation Midweek Update. I'm your host, Dan Perkins.
All right, in San Francisco, Rich Walcott for the W420 Radio Network with the Honorable Willie Brown, former mayor of this great city, also one of the leading Democratic figures in California politics for a generation, and former president of Harborside, which was the first and largest dispensary in California. I didn't know you were a master of cannabis, Mr. Brown, but nothing would surprise me with all your skills and talents.
Well, I'm really not a master of cannabis. Let me tell you, I came upon the opportunity to participate with Harborside. My friend Steve D'Angelo asked me to come over and take a look at Harborside. I did. I went over to take a look at Harborside. And initially, they had me doing some legal work. I became so interested in almost everything Harborside was doing, I started to become a spokesperson or in attendance at the opportunity to organize people nationally around the pot issue. That's how I ended up becoming the chair of the board and the head of Harborside, theoretically.
Yeah, now that we've seen four more states legalize adult use of marijuana, Montana, South Dakota, Arizona, New Jersey, in the recent election, there are now 15 states that have legal adult use of marijuana.
And 32 that have the use of marijuana for medical purposes.
Sure. So it's growing, yet it's still a Schedule I federal, federally forbidden product that is lumped in with methamphetamine and heroin and the like. Do you sense that the new administration, incoming President-elect Joe Biden and first Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, will make concerted efforts to make a change on the classification of cannabis?
Well, I think that the lead on classification of cannabis will have to come from the House. That is where you get the impetus to do it. There's so many other things that Biden and Harris need to take care of. The cannabis is not high on the list. But the minute it's presented to them, it will happen overnight for their acceptance. I'm going to guess that some of what Kamala Harris was doing as a senator will be handed off to some member of the House for the purpose of making sure that it becomes a reality, and she will be, I suspect, in those sessions with President Biden, advocating strongly for approval of if it reaches the desk.
Well, you are a good friend and perceived as a mentor to Kamala Harris for many, many years. She sponsored in the Senate the MORE Act, the Marijuana Reinvestment and Expungement Act, which would not only reclassify cannabis and take it away from the Schedule I, stigma, but also would allow doctors at Veterans Administration to prescribe pot. It would impose a federal excise tax. It would allow interstate trade. It would change the whole banking system. It would be an enormous move, but it is stalled in the Senate, and you can tell me why.
It stalled in the Senate because you've got McConnell running the Senate. If anyone else was running the Senate who had any clear understanding and appreciation, and in particular Rand Paul and the people who are from the more progressive side of the Republican Party, if you can call anybody progressive on the Republican side, I think this time around there will be the kind of effort made to produce it, but I'm telling you, it's got to come from the House over to the Senate. And if that happens, believe me, I think the Biden administration will be enthusiastic.
Now, there was a time when Joe Biden was perceived as a man who could reach across the aisle and make bipartisan partnerships and alliances and the like. You were known for doing similar, you know, across the aisle efforts in California. Are those days in the bygone past?
No, they're not. I am telling you that the existence of Trump, more than anything else, has created what appears to be a point beyond which people cannot cooperate. Once Trump is removed, the national scene will be dramatically different. There will be people in the shoes of McCain, in the shoes of people similar to McCain who were there. And they will be the individuals who will be looking for solutions to issues that will not necessarily be flavored with the tribal kind of influence that has come from the Trump world.
When we look at the sales of cannabis worldwide, $12 billion in 2018, it's expected to be $31 billion by 2022. So we're seeing an exponential growth. And the other influential banking act that's being considered is the Safe Banking Act, Secure and Fair Enforcement Banking Act, which would allow cannabis businesses access to financial services, which right now doesn't happen because of federal regulations. But that's got to be key because the EU allows that. Israel, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, we are way behind the world when it comes to the business considerations for cannabis distribution.
Well, fortunately, again, a Californian will have something to say about that. Maxine Waters chairs the Financial Services Committee in the House. And Maxine Waters has been there now for 28 years. She comes from South Central Los Angeles area. She understands very clearly what the issues are. And being an Angeleno and being from California, being an individual who is on the African-American heritage side, she will be key. And she was really smart when she was a member of the California legislature. She's the woman who orchestrated the process by which Nelson Mandela became free as a result of the divestment effort. That was Maxine Waters. She'll do the same thing on the pot side ultimately.
Yeah, the Safe Banking Act is as important, I would think, as the MORE Act.
The Safe Banking Act has an opportunity, and it's because the non-cannabis world benefits from that kind of business handling the financial transactions. My credit card just says Chase. I can't use it to get my cannabis products. I have to go to my bank and get cash and take it. Believe me, Chase, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, every one of those operations would love nothing better than to be the persons who could do the transactions involving cannabis. Just think of what that would mean to their bottom line.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because, as Bob Dylan said, money don't talk, it swears. So we obviously see the incentive for financial institutions to back the Safe Banking Act, to allow cannabis industry representatives to use financial institutions the way every other business does. But getting back to the MORE Act, the fact that we're seeing so many veterans suffering from opiate problems with PTSD and suicide, I'm almost one an hour, 20 more a day of veterans in this country taking their own lives. Total tragedy in so many ways. And the fact that cannabis cannot be prescribed by physicians at the VA, and that would be allowed under the MORE Act. Do you have some thoughts on that and what might be an impetus?
Absolutely. Let me assure you that if in the legislative process you are conscious of how you can manage it, you take pieces of it on a piece-by-piece basis, if necessary. Clearly, if you have the aroma of veteran needs being addressed effectively, you instantly take away the criticism that comes from people who say, no pot. They have a hard time if some guy has risked his life to save our country and he needs some relief, a prescription by his physician. And his physician may be in place in a particular VA hospital. It would be clear that that individual and those individuals would be in need. Even the most strident person on the issue would have to relent.
Yeah, isn't it curious that it would possibly take veterans in need of a medicine that heretofore perceived as sort of this diabolical weed in the eyes of many in the old school view, but that's evolving and that's changing. But you've been around a number of decades to see the change in the perception of cannabis. So can you just talk to me about how that is evolving? It is maybe escalating or accelerating faster than anyone would have imagined.
Well, it's all because the business of communicating in this country plays a great role in educating people and changing the views of people. And social media does that probably more effectively than any others. Social media can be destructive, as the Trump operation has proven, period. But on the other hand, it can be clearly informative, clearly uplifting in some cases, and educational. And believe me, what happens with veterans, we get better reaction when the world knows what we're doing with veterans. Many years ago, we only knew about the veterans in our own neighborhood, our own friends, our own relatives. Now we know the veteran who may live in St. Louis or Mineola, where I came from, or in Denver or in Washington. It's amazing how the communication system can equip us to be sympathetic, sensitive, and humane, mm-hmm. no matter where.
Yeah, and speaking of the evolution, I mean, Kamala Harris, the vice president-elect, a few short years ago was prosecuting people as an attorney general in California with marijuana offenses, and now she's one of the leading advocates to expunge those criminal records. And it would really mean a lot in the minority community, in the underserved communities, and the poor people who are disproportionately arrested, convicted, and sentenced.
There are so many people whose lives have been altered, whose careers have been destroyed because of the horror laws that we had in place surrounding cannabis, nationally and state by state. Kamala Harris, as a true prosecutor, obeyed whatever was on the books. She applied her skills for the purpose of the content of that against whomever might be so exposed. In the process, she clearly gained a considerable amount of knowledge, and it gives her greater credibility inside of the administration of Joe Biden to be able to say, I was there, I did it, I put some of those people away. Some of those people should not be continuously burdened with a tag that they were somehow incarcerated because of what never should have happened. The law was the law then. We changed the law now. We also have to change the history of the law to remove those disabilities associated with people who were so convicted.
You're very passionate about it. Are you optimistic that we'll see these changes evolve in the next administration?
I am certain that we will see the changes in the next administration.
That's awesome. Willie Brown, great to see you in your town of San Francisco, where you were the mayor and a longtime Democratic stalwart in California politics. Rich Walkoff on the W420 radio network. In case you missed any of this interview or want to hear more of it, the W420radionetwork.com. You go to archive there and you'll learn more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is one of our regulars, Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association. He's going to talk to us today about the vote on the floor of the House on descheduling cannabis. So welcome to the conversation, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump into it. We had the vote on the floor. It passed. There was some, you could say, bipartisan support. There were some Democrats, a lot of Democrats and some Republicans who voted for it. It wasn't unanimous. So we postponed this vote, which was actually scheduled right before the election, because we had been told that some congressmen were concerned that they may put their seats in jeopardy. We'll never know that for sure. But do you have any idea why they postponed the vote?
I mean, well, exactly as you said, I think that some moderate Democrats in very close races were concerned that not only making this a big issue and calling them for a vote before their elections could hurt their chances, but also before doing so before a stimulus package and coronavirus relief had been approved would make it even worse. And you know, the House Democrats took a lot of heat from House and Senate Republicans about that that very thing, you know, despite the fact that this is a perfectly relevant bill and had been on the table for a long time. Now, you know, whether or not either delaying that vote or even just talking about it or voicing their support had any impact on their elections is impossible to tell, as you mentioned. I personally don't think that it had too much effect because, you know, really when it came down to it, this bill was able to get passed through the House before the House and Senate had been able to agree on coronavirus relief anyway. So, even though the same talking points were used by House GOP against the bill this time around, you know, so pretty much a nil effect as far as I'm concerned. But we really can't know what the impact was on elections until we have a little bit more time to actually parse through some of the exit polling and surveys. Yeah. All that being said, you know, this bill had you know, passed by a pretty wide margin, as you said. You know, only six Democrats voted against it, and it was largely because of procedural or detail issues, and five Republicans voted for it. There were a number of abstentions, but you know, this was a really momentous bill. First time that any chamber of Congress has either voted on or passed a bill to make cannabis legal and to remove it from the schedule of controlled substances since the Controlled Substances Act was passed.
As I understand it, the House in their bill wanted to move it off of a level four schedule. But am I incorrect that there are certain provisions in level one that kept it at level one, two?
This bill has always been about removing cannabis from the schedule of controlled substances entirely. So rescheduling was really not part of this legislation at all. And it's you know, absolutely appropriate to remove cannabis from that schedule and treat it more similarly to alcohol.
So when we had after our vote in the House, we had the UN vote on removing cannabis on a global basis from Schedule 4. But as I understand it, they still kept it in certain situations as a Schedule 1 controlled substance. So, and yet we voted, the United States voted in favor of the World Health Organization recommendation to the UN. So are we in the same church, or are we doing different things in our country?
Well, I mean, obviously the direction that states are moving, as well as the direction that Congress seems to be moving, are you know, in the right direction, and supported by science. And the UN seems to be moving in that same direction as well, although I'd have to say that the UN vote was didn't really change all that much practically, although it probably will allow for a little bit more of development of research and trade in countries that have allowed certain medical products to be legalized. But overall, I think that things are trending in the right direction. You know, unfortunately, there are still major opposition forces on the international level as well as at the national level within the U.S. And it does not help that Russia, which is you know, very, very anti-cannabis country in terms of its representation at the UN, is nominally in charge of the UN Office of Drug Control. And so that is going to continue to present barriers to rational drug policy reform at the international level. But you know, what we're seeing is that more and more countries are starting to look at either regulating cannabis for adults, but particularly for medical purposes. And if the U.S. doesn't move quickly to institute rational policy changes through things like the MORE Act, we're going to get left behind in the international market.
There are some people that are now saying, Morgan, that the implication of the UN bill or the UN vote is that because we still have certain restrictions in the United States that we've not been able to legislatively eliminate, that cannabis industry within the United States may be subject to acquisition by foreign powers, foreign corporations who want to not only get in the manufacturing process, but the distribution process in the United States as part of their overall business strategy. Have you heard any of those kind of thoughts?
I mean, well, I'm sure that there is some foreign investment within the U.S. cannabis industry and probably some at least partial ownership. I haven't heard a whole lot about that becoming a major trend. And there are certainly some you know, political and legal concerns when anybody on the investor side or on the receiving end of those investments is starting to consider that. But as far as I know, it's not illegal and hasn't been for some time. I think that it really just depends on what the rules are in the you know, investor home country.
So if we look at this bill, will it go any further without a majority vote in the Senate?
Well, it definitely will not come up during the lame duck session. And it's doubtful that it would be called for a floor vote in the Senate as long as Republicans continue to control that chamber. And even with even if both Democratic candidates in Georgia are able to secure wins, that doesn't necessarily mean that the votes are there to pass such comprehensive legislation. But it does mean that we'd be much more likely to be able to get hearings and votes on incremental changes and certainly be able to start moving things like the MORE Act through committee very quickly, or at least much more quickly than under GOP control. If that is not the case and GOP retains control of the Senate, I think that we can still expect to see hearings and votes on the more incremental changes. They just might not happen as quickly, and it drastically decreases the chances of there being any major hearings or votes on comprehensive changes like the MORE Act. That being said, I think it's pretty clear that both recent polling as well as the results of the elections and ballot initiatives in Montana, South Dakota, and Mississippi should be sending a clear signal to conservative lawmakers that support for this is growing among their base and that at some point they are going to start facing severe political consequences for impeding the progress of things that are not only popular among their base but are also the law of their constituents.
So your organization would be opposed to going from 4 to 3. You would rather see total descheduling. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, cannabis is Schedule 1 according to the Controlled Substances Act, and it would have to go down to 4 or less in order to no longer trigger 280E. Really, any form of descheduling would be incredibly problematic, as well as not appropriate either legally or scientifically.
And what are the challenges of not getting rid of it, but reducing the schedule number? Why would there be a problem with going from 4 to 3?
Well, I mean, you mean from 1 to 2 or any of the below ones? Because Schedule 1 is the the highest level where cannabis is now.
Right. But so am I wrong?
Basically, it depends. Well, I mean, regardless of the schedule, basically it really depends on which schedule it gets moved to that triggers different actions. But none of the rescheduling would resolve the federal-state conflict. Cannabis could still be treated as a criminal substance at the federal level. And in some of the schedules, it would actually force existing dispensaries to become pharmacies, which would be incredibly difficult and kind of decimate the entire industry, whether it be medical or adult use. It also doesn't do anything to resolve the international treaty issues that we were talking about earlier. There's a number of other issues. And really, across the board, it's really just a bad move, both financially and in terms of public policy, to really be pushing for rescheduling as opposed to descheduling.
Do you think that we'll get favorable legislation in 2021?
Well, the issue is definitely going to be under consideration in both chambers. I think that it's going to take an awful lot of pressure to get movement in a Republican-controlled Senate, as we spoke about before. Regardless, I think that there's also going to be a lot of discussion in the House about how exactly to regulate cannabis should it end up becoming legal and descheduled. So, whether that is in the form of an amendment to the MORE Act or through standalone legislation, but it's certainly going to be under consideration. It's probably a little bit too premature to say that anything is going to pass next year, but the possibility is there. However remote it may be, it's definitely there. Regardless, we are going to see forward momentum on not only the issue generally, as well as descheduling and more comprehensive bills, but also a lot of the more incremental bills that deal specifically with things like 280E or research, as we saw that just passed this week in the House, or access through by veterans, and various things like that. Hopefully, we'll also see movement on banking and access to things like the Small Business Administration loan system.
So, unfortunately, Morgan, we're out of time. Tell the audience how they can follow your organization and your positions.
Right. Well, we're available on the web at thecannabisindustry.org, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins for your Songs and Stories for Soldiers, Veterans, Tip of the Day. Did you know the unemployment rate for veterans is 12.5%? Because of the pandemic, the number of homeless veterans is increasing rapidly. In fact, there are waiting lists at VA shelters for people to come. Many of the veterans who go to the homeless shelters find themselves without decent shoes to go out and apply for a job. They come to the VA and they get health care, clothing, food, but they can't get shoes and socks. That's why we started the program. We are in our fourth annual Shoes and Socks for Homeless Veterans Drive. If you want to help, go to songsandstoriesforsoldiers.us and click on the Amazon button where you can order shoes and socks that are sent directly to me, and I will deliver them to the VA facility so veterans will get shoes and socks. That's songsandstoriesforsoldiers.us, Amazon button. This is Dan Perkins for your Veterans Tip of the Day. Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is Alfredo Pasquale, the international analyst at Marijuana Business Daily. I want to talk about something that we're talking a lot about in the United States, and that is a recent UN vote on cannabis. So welcome to the conversation, Alfredo.
Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Can you please tell our audience and me what happened at the UN?
All right. So maybe first I will say what happened in technical terms, and then your next question will probably be what that means. But I'd rather start with what happened in technical terms. So what happened was that the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs, that's the main drug policy making body in the United Nations, basically the countries of the world are the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, represented on the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. That agency, UN agency, decided to accept one World Health Organization recommendation to remove cannabis and cannabis resin from Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. At the same time, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, known as CND, rejected the other five WHO recommendations, or at least rejected some of these and then didn't vote on the other ones because these other ones were implicitly or explicitly connected with the ones that were rejected. So they didn't vote on each of the six recommendations. And for some context, so I mentioned the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, the World Health Organization, and the 1961 Single Convention. So the way that international drug control works, or at least of how it works, because it is more complex than this, is that there are three main international drug control conventions. The 1961 is the one, is one of the, I mean, all three conventions are important for cannabis, but in this particular case, regarding these recommendations and the change that happened a few days ago, what matters the most is that cannabis was originally included in the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs as cannabis in Schedule 4 of that convention. And the way that the convention works is different to, for example, how the United States schedules work. So some might think that Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4 go in increasing or decreasing order of control or how strict these controls are, but that's not exactly how it works. Substances in Schedule 4 of the 1961 Convention are a subset of those that are already in Schedule 1. And substances in Schedule 1 are already the ones that are required the highest level of international control, meaning countries need to provide estimates to the United Nations, a system of import-export permits is required, etc. So why is there a Schedule 4 if substances in Schedule 1 already have the highest level of control? Well, that was something that was done to signal that a group of substances in Schedule 1 have very, very, very limited medical utility and or no medical utility and are very dangerous. So there you have, for example, carfentanil, which is a substance that is extremely dangerous that the Russian army used a few years ago in a hostage situation in a theater, killing more than 100 people accidentally. And it's really dangerous stuff. And cannabis was included there with these substances that have no or extremely limited medical value and are extremely dangerous. So then the WHO comes into play, the World Health Organization. What the WHO did to recommend the CND, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, in January 2019 to remove cannabis from Schedule 4. The WHO did a scientific assessment, they considered the existing evidence, and they came to the very obvious conclusion, I would say, that cannabis is not as dangerous as other substances that are in Schedule 4, and that cannabis indeed has some medical utility. So it shouldn't be placed in Schedule 4. And the recommendation was then to remove cannabis from Schedule 4. That was in January 2019. But the WHO doesn't decide this. The WHO recommends, and then it's up to the CND, the countries, to decide what to do with that. And they consider not only the science of the WHO, but also any legal, administrative, social implications that the decision might have. It was 2 years of debate trying to understand these and the other five recommendations that then we can speak about. And then, thankfully, the final decision was made via a vote in early December to remove cannabis from Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention, meaning that the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs acknowledged that scientific assessment of the WHO, accepted that, and removed cannabis from that Schedule 4 category, leaving it in Schedule 1. It remains in Schedule 1, meaning that it remains with the highest level of international control, but now some medical utility is acknowledged, and it's also acknowledged that it is not as dangerous as once it is.
So, Alfredo, let me ask you a question. I looked at the proposal, and I looked at the vote. And what surprised me was that America voted yes. We have a government that seems to be not interested in
decriminalizing cannabis in the United States. Why do you think the United States voted in favor of the recommendation?
Okay, so that question has different parts, I would say. So first of all, I would say that I've been following the debates at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs very closely these past couple of years. I've attended meetings in Vienna and this year, all the online meetings. And I can tell you with confidence that the United States has been one of the most supportive countries in the Commission on Narcotic Drugs in terms of promoting some reform, update these very, very antiquated international rules, I would say. So that's the first thing, that the countries that oppose changing anything in terms of the status quo are Russia, China, Egypt, and many more, but not the United States. The United States has been quite constructive, I would say. Then when it comes to the recommendation is to remove cannabis from Schedule 4. It implicitly means that some medical value is being recognized by the removal of Schedule 4, and that it is also being recognized that cannabis is not as dangerous as other substances in this category with extremely dangerous substances. So you ask me then, why is the U.S. government doing this while at the same time the U.S. government refuses to enact some form of federal legalization? I would say that while it might look contradictory at first sight, it isn't, because actually the U.S. government at the federal level has already approved certain cannabis or cannabis-related drugs. You have Epidiolex that was approved by the FDA, and this is a CBD drug that is derived from the cannabis plant, and is approved by the FDA, obviously federally legal to be prescribed. So I would say it would have been contradictory if the U.S. had voted against this, because while it has FDA-approved Epidiolex, a vote against this recommendation would be sending the signal, we approve Epidiolex at the federal level, but then we don't want to recognize that cannabis has medical value. That would be a very big contradiction, right? So, I wouldn't call it necessarily contradictory. And one more thing, the fact that cannabis was removed from Schedule 4, remaining in Schedule 1, and that the potential therapeutic value of cannabis was recognized doesn't necessarily mean that countries should now provide access to medical cannabis products that do not have medical trials to prove the efficacy and safety of these. So normally when we talk about medical cannabis, we mean special access schemes that allow patients to have access to cannabis products with a doctor recommendation or whatever it is, depending on the state of the U.S. or the country around the world. And these are products that might be safe to use, but that did not undergo the usual clinical trials of other drugs to prove the efficacy and safety. So that's not necessarily what this removal from Schedule 4 means. It just means that the medical value of cannabis is recognized, but countries are still free to say, well, yes, the medical value is recognized, but show me the clinical trials before I approve any medicine. And that's what the FDA position is right now, right? On a federal level in the U.S., you only have Epidiolex approved and then some drugs with synthetic THC.
One of the things that I've noticed is a lack of a lot of research that you're talking about.
Yeah.
However, that's been changing dramatically over the last couple of years, and there seems to be much more research going on at colleges and universities. Not so much within the pharmaceutical industry, but colleges and universities are doing clinical trials and tests. Is it because the pharmaceutical companies are still concerned about the federal status and they don't want to jeopardize their businesses because they might get arrested for dealing with an illegal drug?
It's a mix of factors. So as you correctly pointed out, doing research is not impossible, but it is complicated, particularly if you want to do it at a federally legal level. I think, you correct me if I am wrong, I'm absolutely no expert in the U.S. markets, but I think at the federal level, the only U.S.-produced cannabis you can use for research is the one that the University of Mississippi produces. Maybe one or two more institutions approved by the federal government, but there's not much to choose from, right?
Right.
Got it. So then research, it is not impossible, but it is complicated. And then the question I think that is worth asking is why is research complicated in the first place? So why do we have these strict rules in the U.S. that discourage research? And I would say that part of the explanation is the scheduling of cannabis on an international level. The fact that it was included until recently, a few days ago, in Schedule 4 of the 1961 Convention. And again, substances in Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention, this is the category of substances that the UN is saying has the least the no medical value or very limited medical value, is still allowed to do research with these substances. That is not prohibited by the Single Convention. But the fact that it is in Schedule 4 acts as a deterrent, because the UN is sending researchers the message, if you want to do research with this, keep in mind that it's a drug that we consider to be very dangerous and that we consider to have no or very limited medical value. So I would say it all starts at an international level, cannabis being placed in Schedule 4, and then national legislations in a way replicate this national scheduling of cannabis. And because cannabis was in Schedule 4, I would say that was part of the explanation why it was scheduled in such a strict category in the U.S. Controlled Substance Act as well, and why then it becomes so complicated to do research in the U.S. at a federally legal level. However, I don't want to promise anything, obviously, but one of the implications of the change at the U.N. level... Hello?
I'm here.
You have me there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, sorry for that. So one of the changes that we can see at national level now is the possibility of rescheduling at national level as well, or at least making the rules broaden the rules to allow for more research. So because now the UN recognized cannabis shouldn't be placed in the most in the strictest category anymore, so why not do that at the same level, right? Of course,
right.
The decisions will be made on a national level, and I'm not saying that this will happen next week, but it is definitely good news, right? So there's one good argument to ask the U.S. federal government to broaden or loosen the rules that allow to do research on a federal level and tell the U.S. government, look, you voted for this in Vienna, so why don't you now be consistent and do the same here at the national level?
How can people follow you and what you're doing?
You should just go to mjbizdaily.com. We have an international section of the website where my articles are published. Otherwise, obviously, you can also find me in social media, particularly Twitter and LinkedIn. Just searching Alfredo Pascual, mjbizdaily, you will find me.
Super. We've been speaking, as I said today, to Alfredo Pasquale, the international analyst at Marijuana Business Daily, and he's been talking about what happened at the UN and its vote. And Alfredo, we need to have you back again to talk about what are the implications in Europe and other parts of the world. So thank you for joining us today.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and joining us today is Pam Moore from Marijuana Business Daily, and she's going to talk to us about the recently passed legislation in the House concerning decriminalization of cannabis. Pam, welcome to the conversation.
Oh, so glad to be here, Daniel. Thanks. What big news.
Thank you. Yeah, well, that's why you're on the show. You've been on with us before, and thank you for coming back. So tell us about
was there something different about this vote and the one last summer where we had the safe banking and other things, and what happened most recently? Is there anything different in the legislation that caused it to get back on the table again?
Well, to be specific, what happened last Friday was a conversation just about the MORE Act, not about the Safe Banking Act. So we were isolated to the MORE Act, which is focused on descheduling cannabis as one key act. And then the second key act, part of the act, is expungement of federal convictions, federal records for marijuana convictions, to kind of make up for some of the tragedies related to the drug wars.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I think that it came back on the table really is because of the conversations the country has been having over the course of this year on questions of social justice. So that, and by that, I mean both the kinds of protests and marches we saw over the spring and summer related to Black Lives Matter and that kind of bringing to awareness of all the social inequity in American society, coupled with the way that the COVID virus, of course, has impacted Black and brown people disproportionately. I think we just have heightened awareness of issues of social justice. And that was the issue that a lot of the legislatures latched onto in terms of their support for this bill and bringing it forward at this time. In relation to COVID, Black and brown people are more likely to be essential workers. They're on the front lines in healthcare and grocery stores, driving buses, doing transportation, often marginalized into those kinds of roles, or otherwise like are in those roles more often because of things like the way that real estate gets sold. They're kind of forced into housing where more people are living in a single dwelling, less represented in healthcare, for really good reasons, more likely to be skeptical about healthcare.
The Center for Disease Control about a month ago released a study that I thought was just absolutely shocking. They said that one in four Americans are seeing increases in anxiety and depression. 25% of the country is suffering from anxiety or serious depression. The center was saying that they believe that a great cause of that is COVID-19. We placed an enormous amount of hope on getting this vaccine from whoever's provided it. But the news is not great in terms of administration or coming in administration is saying that they hope to be able to inoculate 100 million people during the first 100 days of his administration. And that sounds terrific, except there's 227 million that wouldn't get it. And number two, in order to do that, you got to do 1 million people a day, 7 days a week, in order to hit that number. So I'm concerned that we have placed a great deal of false hope on near term that the vaccine is going to do anything regardless of the color of our skin. But I agree with you that perhaps at least the ones that are in the healthcare area are scheduled Black and brown people who work in hospitals and help us and serve us are on the first round list, but that doesn't deal anything with the Black and brown people who live and are not employed in the hospitals or healthcare facilities. I'm concerned that we're going to be disappointed, and the people who were frustrated last summer are going to be wind up being more frustrated, and I don't know how the passage of the MORE Act is going to impact them. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that at least having a vaccine potential is helpful. Of course, people are depressed and anxious. Like, who is not? I'm surprised it's only one in four. Actually, interestingly, that's one of the reasons I think that we've seen so much increase in marijuana and, for that matter, CBD sales over the course of 2020, people self-medicating a bit to get through. It's in terms of the MORE Act and its impact on social justice, I think there's two streams of thought that I've heard in reaction to the vote in the House. One is that, of course, they're a big point of it coming to the floor, as we've mentioned, and a big point of the act itself and the language in the act is to provide some level of social equity. So there's recognition that Black and brown people have been disproportionately targeted. In the war on drugs, we have way too many people at the federal level in the criminal justice system because of marijuana, when actually its use is just as high in white communities as in other communities. So it's meant to recognize that and expunge those records. Sounds like a good thing, and it is a good thing. There are some rubs, though, as well, that I think lots of people are chatting about now, too. So the rubs include, at the sort of last minute, there was a late amendment to the MORE Act that allowed the federal government to prevent people with marijuana-related felonies from working in the cannabis industry. So a little bit of a contradiction in terms of what we're meant to achieve. So your record would be expunged, but you still wouldn't necessarily be allowed to work in the cannabis industry.
Wow.
We see the same things. Yeah, interesting. The same kind of rules apply in alcohol. So it's hard to get a license to sell alcohol in some states if you have a federal conviction. But what that, so in a way it feels parallel, but what that ignores is how race has impacted convictions in the first place when we're talking about cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
A second issue that I've heard many folks discussing is that something like the MORE Act and the descheduling of cannabis opens the door to big business. Like, this is why people are excited about it.
Well, you're interesting because as I read the act, and you can certainly correct me, the big thing that was impacting the formation of businesses and interest in the cannabis space was the federal tax statute of 280E, where you really couldn't deduct anything. So even you have to have decriminalization, you have to have a revision in the tax structure to get rid of 280E, because I don't think businesses, big businesses, will go in to the cannabis space without the ability to deduct expenses like they do in every other business. It's going to be tough. And what do you think about that?
That's right. 280E only, and that inability to take those deductions only applies to those Schedule I drugs. So if we reschedule cannabis, 280E no longer applies. That said, the legislation did come in with a new excise tax, but that would be set at 5% of cost to start and would increase over time to 8%. So there are some nice revenues, but that does eliminate the obstacles of those deductions. The Congressional Budget Office came out with an analysis that said, were MORE Act 2 passed, with this new excise tax in place, that would mean $13.7 billion in revenues coming into the federal government, like federal tax, from 2021 to 2030. And at the same time, it would cut federal prison spending by $1 billion in that same period. So
wow.
Given economic conditions in the wake of COVID, there is some benefit when we start to talk about the tax code.
So, unfortunately, we're out of time, Pam. Tell people, we've been speaking with Pam Moore from Marijuana Business Daily about the MORE Act. Tell us how we can follow you and you keep up to date on what's happening in Congress.
I would send people straight to MJ Biz Daily, which is where we post all our stories. We've been doing great coverage of this. You'll also find there links to all of our social media channels. We'll talk soon again, I hope, Daniel.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com. America's Cannabis Conversation.